Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today on the program, I'm talking with Felicia Rose Chavez about her book, The Anti-Racist Writing Workshop, How to Decolonize the Creative Classroom. Felicia, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Happy to participate today.
Yeah. Could you tell us a bit about your kind of journey as a writer and why you wanted to write this book in particular?
Sure. I think my journey as a writer is necessarily intertwined with my journey as a teacher. I gravitated toward the English classroom as a high school student and an undergraduate student. I was, first generation college student, and had to support myself through school. And so I would tutor as often as possible. I was a private tutor. And a lot of times that meant teaching writing to young people. And after I graduated college, I found kind of the love of my life, which happened to be a nonprofit organization that allowed me to serve as a teaching artist, which I think is such a fabulous title that encapsulates what it is to be a working professional as well as a mentor, which is a different relationship than, say, like being a professor. So I learned teaching and the art of teaching as like an integral part of being a working artist, being a person who created, and that those could exist side by side. It didn't have to be this weary, like, oh, maybe in the summer I can do my own work, and this hostility towards students for taking time away. They existed, they coexisted. And I found myself more and more writing about what happened in the classroom, writing about teaching. And so, I shifted my focus as a University of Iowa MFA candidate. I entered into the nonfiction writing program and was, I had a difficult time in that program. I think that I clung even closer to my own practice in the classroom as a result of racial hostility within my own graduate classes. So I thought, what can I create in my undergraduate classes? And found myself writing about that as well. So of course, later down the line, I'm reflecting on myself and my journey through memoir and the stories that I have to tell are about this educational trauma and how I faced that on the page and pivoted in the classroom to create my own teaching policies that refuted the tradition of toxic racism for our students of color.
Yeah. And you definitely write about the sort of implicit biases that go on in a lot of these MFA programs and other writing programs. But you also talk about just how hierarchical this relationship is between the students and the instructors in the kind of traditional model. I feel like you could almost call this book, the anti-capitalist writing workshop or nice. Or something like that, because it really is about kind of flattening those hierarchies of saying, I'm the expert and you are going to receive the information that I have to give you.
Totally. I call it, you know, I call it a memoir of my own educational journey, but it's a memoir in decentering whiteness and decentering authority, which is a lot of times what we don't think about when we think of anti-racist work. We tend to center on race. But race comes, you know, white supremacy comes with a long legacy of ego, domination, manipulation, and this sense of authority over others that we need to question and decolonize those practices alongside the other practices of the anti-racist work.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and kind of the idea of why is decolonizing the creative classroom not quite the same thing as diversifying the syllabus?
Sure. This is the distinction between inclusion, right? Oh, well, we need to include people of color on our reading list and just kind of like nod our head in recognition that artists of color, scholars of color exist in this world, right? We share space versus decentering whiteness. So when whiteness serves as neutral and objective, right? When it is the universal standard, that's when we get into trouble because we are normalizing what it is to be white, that history, that aesthetic preference, even craft itself, right? We're defining those terms, we're situating them squarely in this idea of what it is to be white. And so when we open that up, when we broaden it, dissect it, we're able to multiply, invite in a whole variety of definitions, new definitions that have existed throughout the world forever. We just haven't acknowledged them. We've been so focused on this white hegemony, this Western hegemony. And so when we allow and invite in an alternative definition of what is craft, what is critique? What is storytelling? And how many different ways can those things, you know, express themselves on the page? It's truly beautiful. I get students who, when they're able to just read their own writing aloud, just that simple gesture of not silencing the writer so that I can experience your work on the page and tell you what I think of it, but invite you to read the words aloud in your own voice. I hear students including the language of home more and more because they know that people won't mispronounce it or people won't question or not understand it or critique it. Instead, they're able to own that language. And it's just so beautiful as they read the words aloud.
So yeah, this was reminding me of a conversation I had actually yesterday with the poet Joshua Bennett, who was talking about spoken word poetry and kind of mentioned this idea that in the Black poetic tradition, you know, all poetry has a spoken, you know, performed quality to it, which is, you know, maybe not quite how someone like, I don't know, Wallace Stevens would think about his poetry. Do you think there's something kind of implicitly anti-racist just about that act of insisting that there is a kind of live embodied aspect to creative writing?
Absolutely. I mean, so many of my practices that I choose to implement in the classroom draw on this embodied relationship to writing. I think it's essential that we do not lose our bodies in the process of writing. We do not lose our identities. I read something the other day, you know, I get these beautiful letters from writers and educators who have experienced the book. And someone was saying that it took them, it took a white graduate school instructor to inform her, just as an observation about her own writing, that she does not write any characters of color. And she thought, what? Like, this was like a revolutionary note that she received. She had never thought about it before. And I think the more and more we remove our own bodies from the writing process, the more we're able to eliminate ourselves as an act of internalized racism within the writing classroom. in order to achieve the standard, right? That what I spoke of earlier, that universal standard. So I advocate that students write by hand if possible, right? That we write quickly and that it's messy and that we share every day. We physically stand if possible and read our work aloud. And that's not the final polished version for those who are invited at the end, the best writers, right? This is every single one of us in that raw, messy stage. And then we interact with the work. We highlight it and write on it and cut it up and exchange it with one another because it matters that we're very much owning those words, right? It's not this private, siloed writing experience of the woe is me writer suffering through the process, right? That's its own thing. And we're separating ourselves from that tradition. That's very much of the traditional writing workshop. The anti-racist workshop is, you know, what is your name? What scares you about writing? Who are your mentors? Bring them into the classroom and share them with us, right? Play the album that you listen to every morning. Recite those lyrics that really move you. Bring that into your own work. Acknowledge what other people are doing and champion them as opposed to compete with them. So the more we're embodied, the more we can really truly feel one another, love one another, support one another in the classroom, as well as ourselves and listening to ourselves and honoring our own intuition, which is, I think, the greatest skill that we can teach our young writers moving forward is to trust in themselves.
There's a sentence in your book that really stuck out to me, which was, silencing writers is central to the traditional writing workshop model. That's such a counterintuitive idea, and yet it's so true in a very literal sense. Could you talk a bit about what you mean by that and how you work to counter that in your own workshops?
Isn't it strange that, that's the paradox that I point out in the book, is that so many of us enter into these writing workshops to exercise voice, and yet we're denied that voice in the process, which is so bizarre. And this, I'm speaking specifically to our writers of color. I think that, the traditional model is one in such, and some people are surprised by this. A student will submit a piece of work to their classmates and professor. They take it home in advance of the workshop, and everyone writes, reads and writes all over the text. So I've received drafts of my work back in a big messy stack at the end of workshop, in which people have crossed out entire pages. You don't need this written right at the top, or individual words, like sentence by sentence, little words crossed out and replaced with their own suggestions of words. It's an exercise in controlling another person's text, right? And that's just the draft itself. Then we go on to write letters to one another. Here's what you should change. Here's what's working and here's what's not working. I'm going to provide you my vision for your work without hearing first what you're interested in achieving. And then we convene together, and the writer is silent during that practice. It's maybe an hour, hour and a half, in which the writer is just supposed to physically bow their head and take notes in the exercise of listening to what everyone else is saying about their work. And those conversations can easily be derailed by, 30 minutes on. Should she say empanada or not? Because I don't know what empanada is, right? And it's just, It can truly get ridiculous and weary and harmful in terms of what white readers find safe and easily navigate on the page, and what they find challenging and shut down or shut out or unwilling to relate to or do that extra work to relate to. And so our writers all writers, but especially writers of color, tend to leave that experience feeling shut down, feeling like if they don't satisfy their white peers or professors by changing their text, then they haven't succeeded. So that is the silencing that happens just within a traditional workshop model itself. Beyond that, we've got an all-white faculty, a majority white writing cohort. We've got a majority white reading list. And so again and again, this, you know, the awards, the fellowships, the postgraduate fellowships awarded to white students, like it's just one message on top of another, on top of another, that our voices don't matter.
You give an example in the book. I'm forgetting the writer who you're quoting, but she submitted a story where a family was going to get dim sum, and the reactions of her white students were primarily around speculating on what dim sum might mean.
Right? Absolutely. Which, it
really drives home how, you know, this idea that a lot of, you know, white people have, that what they're writing is universal, is totally absurd, because what their idea of what is universal is actually just incredibly parochial.
It's unfortunate that, you know, I remember from my own experience submitting a very short essay about one of my very early attempts of memoir as a graduate student about dating white dudes in high school, and like how my family was like, why is she dating white? Like, that's all she's dating. Why does she date? Does she like white? You know, this was this thing in high school, and it, no one, you know, came to terms with the fact that I was at a majority white public or private school. And that was kind of my options were represented in front of me. Anyway, I wrote about this in a very short piece, and The majority of the workshop was taken up by the fact that people, the white males in the classroom, felt guilty. They felt attacked. They weren't sure if the read was worth that experience. And so it was a conversation among themselves about whether this piece was worthy of publishing if it just made white readers feel bad. And that's not why I went to graduate school. That's not why I went to the University of Iowa. That's not what I wanted to learn. But that was the extent of my education, was this preoccupation with how white readers were going to respond to the text. And it became something that I internalized to such a degree that I just entirely stopped writing memoir. And instead, I chose to tell other people's stories. So for the next, you know, it's a 3-year program. And for the majority of that program, I engaged in multimedia storytelling, in which I did documentaries and graphic essays, digital collage, all about other people's stories instead of my own, because I couldn't deal with it anymore.
Yeah. One of the things that comes up in your book kind of time and time again is how there's often a reaction that people have, you know, primarily white, primarily male, that the kind of changes that you're suggesting in how we run writers' workshops would sort of coddle writers, when in actuality, I mean, so much of the way that these workshops have traditionally been structured is basically coddling the people who are already at the center of, you know, society's imagination, which is like white straight men. Why do you think that criticism is so persistent, and what's so wrong about it?
I love that you say this. Yeah. No, this is fabulous. Thank you. Thank you for putting it that way. I hadn't thought about it that way, but it's absolutely true. I think that the critique often, and perhaps it's because I am a woman of color, is that I am coddling my students with this model. It's feminine. Right? It's mothering my students. When in fact, I'm asking for a reorientation in perspective. People think that when we engage in, for example, the Liz Lerman methodology, that it's somehow soft or too nice. And people want this masculinist, like, you know, bloody, give me everything you got, rip it apart, be as harsh as possible, right? That's the kind of language that we are accustomed to bringing into the room, saying that we can take it. Instead, I ask that folks pause and exercise deep listening, which is to say, stop talking and telling the writer what their work needs to be, and instead engage in a dialogue. You're asking the writer, what is your vision for this work? Where is it now? Where do you want it to be? What did you feel was really successful? What was really hard for you to write and why? What do you need help sorting out? Can you pinpoint three things moving forward that you would like to discuss to best help you evolve this draft into the next draft? That's not to say that in response to this writer, I'm going to agree with everything they say. You know, if they say, I'm really preoccupied with the dad character and I just stuck and I don't know what to do, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to give really valid, helpful, direct feedback. But it is to say that I'm going to be respectful of my own, of their vision and how, and really honor it without imposing my own aesthetic preferences onto that person. I don't like to include men in my work at all. So you should eliminate that dad character, right? That may sound outrageous, but that's what we do all the time to one another. Mm-hmm. You need to transform this into a lyric essay because I write lyric essays and lyric essays are the best. okay, but I'm trying to write a poem, right? So it is not helpful when we do exercise that sense of brutality. And instead, we just shift. And that shift is not babying, coddling, feminizing the process. Instead, it's just engaging in a respectful exchange, which I think is perhaps not the kind of holistic approach that we're accustomed to in academia. We're very much about this passive, fill the receptacle, fill the empty receptacle. The student is lacking, kind of model instead of what is the student bringing? What does the student already have that we can honor and encourage and grow? So again, I think a shift in mentality is really healthy, and it's about time. It's been 80 years that we've exercised the traditional model. Why not try something else?
One of the things you write about in the book is encouraging writers to kind of bring their personal lineage in terms of their artistic and intellectual mentors into the room. So I wonder if I could ask you about a couple of yours. You just kind of mentioned this idea of the student as a kind of passive receptacle for knowledge, which to me brings to mind Paulo Freire. And another kind of mentor that you write about is June Jordan, through her book about poetry for the people. Could you talk about kind of what you take from both of them?
Mm, absolutely. I think that the sense of broadening what we can achieve in a classroom beyond a set skill set, right? I think that a lot of educators create a syllabus to achieve course objectives such as, learning how to write a thesis statement, learning how to organize ideas on the page, right? And while those are valid skills, absolutely, I opt for a different skill set in my course objectives that include empathy and liberation, freedom, ownership, power, right? And by power, I mean a sense of personal power, the identification of self as writer, which a lot of people are quick to eschew, right? They're quick to deny any sense of creativity. I'm not talented. I'm not a writer. I'm not creative, because they've been told over and over and over again that they don't fit this white standard of what it means to be a good writer or good at grammar. When we shift our perspective and we embrace an alternative set of values, we're exercising what Pedagogy of the Press tells us, which is that we can truly shift from being this slave culture into our own liberators, our own sense of power and freedom by just owning our own voice and recognizing that we can be allies with our educators. We can be active in our own education. June Jordan exemplifies this beautifully in her own, you know, University of California, Berkeley writing classes. Poetry for the People was so huge for me because it was an extension of the work that I was engaged in the early 2000s at Young Chicago Authors, working with high school students and truly being a part of their lives. She has a quote that I include in the book about essentially like school not killing you. It's possible not to leave dead, right? And I had to come to terms with that. I had to come to terms with what school killed in me. That was very much alive at the beginning of my educational journey. And she works to revitalize that in her young people, especially her young writers of color. And she firmly plants that work in their own communities. So that's that invitation to ask students, what do you read? What do you listen to? What do you watch? Oh, that's not on a syllabus in a traditional high school or college course, but let's put it on ours and let's study it for inspiration. There's a class that I teach called the Inspiration Lab in which students create the entire syllabus. The entire reading list is theirs to own. And we experience their work, the work that they go to when they're feeling down or when they're just, you know, when they're, as we say in our household, right, when your cup is empty, what do you gravitate toward? So I've watched like Black Mirror and I've listened to Jay-Z and like, what is it that they're into? And then how can we glean inspiration from that? Because the idea is that these students are going to hopefully embrace a lifetime of exercising voice, and they're not always going to have people prompting them with assignments to exercise that voice. So if they need to source the inspiration, why not from their own lives? Get them accustomed to doing so, and they'll always, always have a secure sense of inspiration because they just look around them. It doesn't have to come from an authority figure.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to read another sentence that kind of stuck in my mind when I read your book, which was, "What may read as a crisis in creative writing is at heart a crisis in American culture. Without voice, participatory democracy fails." That's a pretty grand claim for the kind of importance of creative writing. I certainly endorse the grandness there, but could you talk a bit about what do you mean by that sentence?
Sure. When we look at a classroom, we see this contained experience. We see, you know, the opportunity to, you know, delve into a subject, pair it back, dates, facts, sometimes mirror in our own writing the aesthetic preference of our teacher so that we are awarded with a grade that's passable. If we see it in that alternative sense, the values that I shared earlier, then we see our students going inward, learning to listen to themselves and trust their own voices. We're learning that together, that it's okay to say, you're not allowed to treat me this way. Let's stop the conversation here. I have the power to do so, and I would like to exercise that power. I don't want to hear anymore about X, Y, or Z. And that's okay. It's okay to say these things. The more that we build up this generation of young people who are capable of doing this, they can go forward and create their own work, right? So I'm playing the long game here, so just stick with me. Mm-hmm. They can go mm-hmm. forward and create their own work. And then we've got the next generation who sees these people around them. They see them in the literary journals. They see them on the bookshelves, right? They see, we're starting to see our politicians shift in demographic, right? And there's power. Just to see yourself replicated elsewhere, because so often we don't see ourselves in these positions of power. We don't see ourselves on the page. When we're able to do so, then we can trust, okay, my voice matters. Not only am I listening to myself, but my voice matters to other people. Then we can go on to trust that a vote will actually matter, right? Because a lot of the times, and I've said it myself, who am I, right? I, like, when I look at my country and the representation around me, who am I? I'm the person locked up in a cell at the border, right? And it's terrifying. It's terrifying and it's diminishing. It's sad. It's heartbreaking. To be a person of color, it's everyday hardship. It's everyday, it's a fight. And so the optimism and the hope is that the more we build up our young people to trust and to listen to and trust in themselves, to see themselves represented around them, the more hope we have for a stronger, you know, globalized community here, right here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found really interesting about your book is your discussion of participating in other classes outside of kind of your original major at Iowa, or I don't know if it was called a major, but your original focus at Iowa, and seeing how people in different disciplines dealt with these same questions of kind of how to do a workshop, how to do feedback. Could you talk a bit about kind of how, what you learned from how different disciplines approach this idea?
Yeah, this was, it was terrifying work, to be honest with you. It's hard to step out of what you are told you're good at and enter into, especially at the graduate level, a domain of, you know, someone else's territory, a domain of where you think you're just a novice. But I tried it because I was that desperate. I could not stand the thought of doing another writing workshop. And so I started, what's it called? I asked, you know,
the
department. Yeah, yes, yeah. I asked the department head to substitute some of my workshops for alternative workshops outside of the department. And so I entered into a performance writing workshop. So I kind of lay these out in the book in this experience, but it was going into a performance writing workshop where people were creating stuff on the spot. And it was so generous. Like, it was so community-centered. It just kind of blew my mind. I wasn't accustomed to folks collaborating and being so supportive of one another in this performance environment in my own, you know, nonfiction writing. We all just kind of suffered alone in silence and then presented and were either like catty or jealous or, you know, overly approving of one another. You know, they exercised pops. That was their workshop technique. And so they would read the work aloud on the spot, and people would say, "Ooh, I like this. I like this. I like this. This is working." Affirming that there's something to the work that's inherently good. That was kind of mind-blowing for me because in my own sphere, we were very much quick to say what wasn't working. And so this was a spin on that approach, this idea of pops. I did a book arts workshop that taught me that it's okay. A workshop can look like, 12 people sitting around a table and just asking questions of the artist. So tell me about this. And not like loaded, mean, secret opinion questions. Like, why would you do that? You know, instead, like truly, sincerely wanting to know about the process. And so that shifted for me that it doesn't always have to be about the product in hand. It's not like, oh, I'm going to go on to publish this, so I need your immediate notes. Instead, it's here's an attempt something I did. And let's talk about what led up to that. What was your inspiration? What were your ideas behind creating this piece? Where do you want it to go? Assuming that it's not finished. And that was again, a mind-blowing moment for me. And then I did an intermediate arts class. And that was funky and fun in that everyone was kind of working in their own medium. And so the filmmaker impressed upon me during workshop the ability to just shut one another down, which may sound terrible, but actually is wonderfully empowering. When someone's offering you a prescriptive idea, you need to change the ending. The ending's not working at all. And you can say, no, I like the ending the way it is, but thank you. Let's move on to the next question. That was incredible to me. I was like, you can't say that. You can't tell. You're supposed to say, oh my goodness, now I know that my ending is awful. And now I'm gonna torture myself trying to change it to satisfy you, right? But instead, this person was so self-assured about her own art, and that was stunning. So this exposure to different workshops just allowed me to see that there were different possibilities and that it's okay to deviate and healthy and positive to deviate from this one model that we've been clinging to so dearly for so long. Other alternatives exist and people are out there practicing them, and it's tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that anecdote brings to mind for me is just how common it is to go through an entire workshop process of a piece of writing without anyone ever asking the writer what they're trying to do, like what their goals are with that piece, or even what their goals are as a writer. And so it's just assumed that everyone's goal is to write something that's, you know, quote unquote, good, and that everybody knows what that means.
Exactly. Well, that's where the decentering whiteness is essential, right? Because what's good is based on a model of craft, these craft concepts that we consider immovable, right? They just are, and they've existed forever. And we need to contort ourselves to achieve these craft concepts. A lot of times these aren't even defined. We're just supposed to observe them on the page and then parrot them ourselves. And by doing so, you know, if we're just handed a big, fat, heavy, expensive, dusty anthology of white male authors, then that's what we're supposed to replicate. That's what's called writing right. And so when we shift, we're opening up craft for discussion. We're able to say, well, what is voice exactly? What is it to you? What is it to you? Oh, we have alternate definitions. Let's settle on something so that we can agree and look for that craft feature in our own texts as a class, right? So this is an exercise that I do with my own students, which is to collectively define the craft concepts. And then when we're able to talk about an author's work, they can say, I'm curious how voice is working in my piece, right? And we'll all look at it having that same shared definition, agreed upon definition of voice. And we can truly be specific and help that author achieve what he, she, or they wants to achieve on the page. So it is most certainly odd that we don't engage the author in a conversation about their own work.
What do you say when people say, well, this process of, you know, collectively defining what these craft terms are, that feels like reinventing the wheel. What do you say to that kind of a criticism?
That wheel doesn't exist. Like, you know?
Nobody actually knows what these terms mean, right? There's this assumption that everybody knows what structure is, but actually not really, right?
Absolutely. I mean, for example, I was told, you know, I remember presenting a piece in which I was, and I give this as a kind of a sneaky nod to myself in the book. When someone asks about voice I'm explaining the Liz Lerman workshop method, the critical response process, which I advocate as a practice in my own classroom. And so I give an example there where someone's like, what are you trying to achieve with the voice in this piece? And so I reference a Richard Rodriguez model in which I'm offering a telling, right? As opposed to a showing. And that idiom, show, don't tell, came up so many times in the feedback that I received about this, a particular essay that I wrote in graduate school. And I wanted to shake everybody and say, but I'm not trying to achieve that model. I'm not trying to achieve that craft element. There are other ways of storytelling that especially our writers of color exercise on the page, which is, I'm going to tell you about my experience because you need to hear it and understand it because you haven't been exposed to it yet. I can't nod slyly about this because we need to face head on what it is that I have to say. And so it is very narrow thinking to imagine that craft concepts have only one definition. I love to ask students, what is voice? And they say, I don't know, tell me what voice is. And I say, look to your own writing. What are you already doing? How are you exemplifying voice? And so they study themselves and they say, well, I guess I'm doing this and this, right? And they bring it in and then they branch outward and they read other models of people who are kind of in the same aesthetic camp as they are. And they say, oh, they're also doing this and this. So there's a couple more tools to throw in the toolbox. And then when we come together, it is quite empowering as opposed to time consuming, right? It is one class period per craft concept, and I only limit it to four so that we can have a narrow enough focus on what we're doing, but have a handle on a variety of craft elements. It's time well spent in terms of really educating our students, actively including them, as I said before, in their own education. When we just tell them the tool, it doesn't stick. You know, I've got students in college still asking me, oh, what's an adverb? It doesn't stick when you just tell them the information. Mm-hmm. So invite them into the learning process. Ask their opinion. It's worth the time and effort because that's what real education is. It's not just a collection of assumptions that we all share moving forward.
I'd like to ask you some more specific questions, kind of more granular, I guess. How do you, as an instructor, encourage more people of color to take creative writing classes in the first place?
Sure. I think it's essential that as creative writing instructors and as an instructor in any discipline, that we actively articulate the fact that we've created an anti-racist environment within our course. I publicly state that I teach an anti-racist writing workshop. I recruit in different departments on campus, as well as among student groups. So for example, I'll write all first generation college students, or I'll write the LGBTQ group on campus, feminist coalition there is on campus, in addition to kind of race-based coalitions. And I invite those students into my own classroom. I articulate the fact that I teach an anti-racist writing workshop. I talk about my own past experience in workshop and then go on to say how my workshop differs. I might include a list of writers that I'm inspired by and ask them to respond with someone that they're inspired by. But the idea is that I am every element of this is active. I've actively changed my curriculum. I've actively changed my mindset. I'm actively articulating the fact that I am different from other writing workshops on campus, and I'm actively pursuing these students to join my class, whether or not they're creative, and that that's not a necessary identifying factor for them kind of enrolling in the class, that I will meet them where they're at, knowing that we're all inherently creative. That is like a sneaky little secret that'll come back to them later, that they're in totally creative and awesome and inspiring. And so, yeah, it takes work. I think that a lot of times we think, oh, we need to up the numbers of our underrepresented students, of our students of color, of our minority students, whatever term people use, right? And we think that by, let's say, diversifying the course list. Okay, I threw in some writers of color. There we go. I did the work, right? I'm so proud of myself. I'm doing the work. We're not prepared for change. And that's the second. Is that the first? It's the first chapter of the book is called Preparing for Change, because it takes so much more work than that, than, you know, altering your reading list. It takes a shift in mentality, and it takes some real deep thinking about your teaching bias and your teaching inheritance. So as instructors, we've all inherited a teaching legacy that often goes unexamined. When we sit and we think, how was I taught? And why do I teach the way that I do? And who is my ideal imagined student? And why, right? When we ask ourselves these kinds of tough questions, it becomes clear that we're reinstating a legacy of bias that needs to change. So it takes some work.
And then what about the first day of class? How do you sort of set a tone for the semester?
So the first day of class is often dedicated to just like a quick review of the syllabus and then thank you, everybody. Goodbye. I like to keep my students in the room for the length of the class. I start with a ritual that will continue every day we meet called check-in. And that's me addressing the student by name aloud and asking them how they're doing. And we repeat this process student by student by student until every student has shared how they're doing. And that first day of class, they're like, I don't know, I'm fine. It's so hostile and dismissive of me. Totally understandable. Like it's an annoying thing to get used to. But by the end of like that first or second week, they're if not like into, they're at least anticipating the ritual. They've heard the rhythm of each other's names over and over again, so that by the latest mid-semester, they already know one another's names. They can address each other by name, which is the magical power of check-in. But they're also more and more vulnerable as the class proceeds. So they're able to say by week three, oh, my apartment got broken to and I'm really freaked out and I don't know what to do, right? Or I got this new job and everyone's clapping and it's really exciting and we can start to become a community. So day one, that's essential, right? We start with check-in. We also do writing in real time on that first day of class. And we go on to the terrifying prospect of reading that work aloud immediately within that class period. The exercise that I always do on the first day of class is addressing our insecurities, our fears around reading and writing. I think it's just a skill set that we're expected to do, and not a lot of people ask us our relationship to that skill set. It's just a habit that we, you know, take on. Oh, I pound out the pages or whatever it may be. I've just, you know, completing the assignment. When we really sit to think, how do you feel about writing? What emotions does that evoke in you, right? What are you afraid of when it comes to writing or reading aloud? It inspires a lot of emotions and people capture that on the page. And then we share those aloud, which is terrifying. I am afraid to write in this class because I think that everyone will think my writing's stupid. And we answer that one by one by saying, but I will write anyway. So everyone goes around. I'm afraid to write because I'm insecure about my vocabulary. I don't have a lot of words to draw from, but I will write anyway. And we repeat this mantra over and over again. And so by the time students leave, we're trying to disrupt all of the classes around us by cheering so loudly for one another, by the fact that we're vulnerable individuals. We're all human beings with a name, and we're all going to attempt writing anyway, despite all the things, all the reasons not to, especially that voice within our head. So that's what a day one would look like.
And then how do you grade your students? That seems like a very potentially tricky area if you're trying to, you know, encourage students to find their own individual voice.
Sure. This is also a student-centered practice. So if on day one, a student is terrified to read their work aloud, is terrified to write a personal narrative because they've been told their entire lives not to put their business out on the street. That's not something our family does, right? It's this cultural imperative of silence, and they're working against that, right? They articulate that in their own free write, and they've shared that with everyone. They've shared it with me as well. That's a stake in their own education. They're setting down a flag and saying, here's what I'm afraid to do. And then they go on to do it, but I will write anyway. Mm-hmm. So throughout the semester, they work toward accomplishing, getting past, right, those fears and actually doing that work. This particular student that I'm suggesting does write a personal narrative and writes a reflective letter mid-course to their professor and peers saying, you know, this is what I call the artist statement. And they say, here's what I'm feeling really nervous about this piece. Here's what it's doing. Here's what I want it to do, right? Here's the feedback that I need. And then we have another conversation afterward about how that workshop went. And they share their reflections on the workshop and what they want to change about the piece as a result of the workshop. And then at the end of the course, they create a reflective portfolio and they point to, oh my gosh, look at this very early free write that I wrote. And then look at where I was mid-semester. And now look at where I am now. And here are the mentors along the way who have helped me. And they rip out excerpts from different readings, including their peers' work. And they paste it, you know, cut and paste style, like real scissors and glue alongside their own work, sentence by sentence. Here, this is where I got inspiration for this. And they point to it. And at the end, they write that last reflective letter. Here's what I achieved. I'm so proud of myself. I did it. I wrote a personal narrative and it's amazing. And these are the things that, these are the craft elements that shine. And here's what I really need to work on. And so all along the way, they are assessing themselves, right? And it isn't in terms of a letter grade. If you were going to ask me, you know, at the top of class, what letter grade are you going to assign these students, right? Everybody gets an A. Everybody gets an A, depending on their level of commitment to the process. To me, it's going back to a different standard. So if they're able to achieve the thing that paralyzed them initially, that to me is A-level work. Astounding, right? And I need to support them in that. So often, students don't look for their grade. They never ask me for their grade. It's kind of beside the point because they're really, really proud of the work that they produce.
As a final question, you wrote this book that is about, you know, creative writing, the creative writing classroom. But, you know, I'm interviewing you about the book for a podcast, you know, ostensibly about performing arts. And you've said that you've kind of heard from other people from in other disciplines who've read the book and found things that are valuable in it. So how do you see some of the lessons from your book applying to other fields?
I think it's disappointing when folks from other disciplines can't extrapolate ideas out of this text. I wasn't intending to present a replicable model that I wanted people to kind of, you know, mimic from start to finish, right? I wanted an invitation to dialogue. I wanted an invitation for educators across the spectrum to ask themselves questions, but to ask one another questions. What are you doing? What are you doing? And how can I adapt that to my own community? I've done these trainings. I mean, I do facilitations all over the country, and I've done them with instructors in math and science, in the humanities, outside of, you know, a dance class, a second grade elementary school class. Like there's wisdom to share, right? And the better we are able to listen, the more that we can draw from one another, borrow from one another, and really improve our own practice. I remember doing a facilitation with a whole department of rhetoric and comp instructors. And at the end, we did the Q&A, and a woman held up the book, The Anti-Racist Writing Workshop, and said, "Hey, this is great, but have you ever considered writing one of these for rhetoric and comp?" And I thought, oh no. Like, that's so disappointing that we went through this whole hour together, hour and a half, and yet there's nothing that you closed down at the mention of writing workshop. Because it felt like, oh, that's just applicable to the creative writing classroom. I think that there are gifts that we can give one another across disciplines and age groups. As I've been so lucky to receive gifts from educators throughout my own life in different disciplines and across age spectrums. So I just want to continue in that tradition of what I call talking shop instead of workshopping. Let's as educators, it's time to talk shop and swap ideas and try new things. Risk is the precursor to innovation, and it's time to exercise that risk for the benefit of our students of color.
Well, Felicia Rose Travis, thank you so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about your book, The Anti-Racist Writing Workshop. I really enjoyed the book, and I really enjoyed getting to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.